Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The return of humanitarian flights to Kabul since the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan is a turning point in the crisis, the World Food Programme said on Tuesday. More than 9 in 10 families are struggling to find enough to eat, and with winter fast approaching, aid agencies have been scrambling to meet massive needs before it's too late, said WFP spokesperson Thompson Thierry, who is speaking in Geneva. The WFP-led humanitarian air service has completed 3 cargo flights since the reopening of the airlink to Kabul on the 12th of September, bringing in medical supplies on behalf of the World Health Organization. This has enabled humanitarian responders and much-needed relief items to reach desperate Afghans in multiple locations across the country, Mr. Thierry said. WFP has been stepping up its operations. However, $30 million is needed to keep the air services going on top of the $200 million needed to replenish and deliver food supplies, the WFP spokesperson said.
Our food convoys are moving across the country, and in August alone, more than 400,000 people received assistance. In order for us to avert a humanitarian catastrophe, much more is needed. The World Food Programme needs to reach 9 million people a month by November if it is to meet its planned target of 14 million by the end of 2021.
The future for Syria's people is increasingly bleak, UN-appointed rights experts said on Tuesday, highlighting escalating conflict in several areas of the war-ravaged country, a return to siege tactics and demonstrations linked to the plummeting economy. The UN Commission of Inquiry's findings come amid an uptick in violence in the northwest, northeast and south of the country. The parties to the conflict continue to perpetrate war crimes and crimes against humanity and infringing the basic human rights of Syrians, said head of the Commission of Inquiry, Paolo Pinheiro. Professor Pinheiro also described as scandalous the fact that many thousands of non-Syrian children born to former IS fighters continue to be held in detention in dreadful conditions in Syria's northeast.
Most foreign children remain deprived of their liberty since their home countries refuse to repatriate them. We have the impression the most ratified convention in the world, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, is completely forgotten, and democratic states that are supposed to abide to this convention, they neglect the obligations of this convention in what is happening in Al Hol and other camps and prison places.
Some 40,000 children continue to be held in camps, including Al Hol. Nearly half are Iraqi and 7,800 are from nearly 60 other countries, according to the Commission of Inquiry report, which covers the period from the 1st of July 2020 to the 30th of June 2021. To Yemen, finally, where years of war have continued to cause unremitting suffering for the country's people. In a new alert at the Human Rights Council on Tuesday, a panel of UN-appointed independent experts highlighted how all parties to the conflict have continued to commit serious violations of international human rights and humanitarian laws, many likely war crimes. The expert panel pointed to a lack of political will by the international community to push for an end to the fighting, while also calling for the supply of arms to Yemen by third parties to stop. According to the experts' latest report, the last 12 months of conflict in Yemen have been marked by shelling incidents which have continued to kill and injure civilians. The actions of all parties to the conflict have made the humanitarian crisis worse, they insisted, pointing to blockades and restrictions on food supplies and aid access. Arbitrary detention and forced disappearances and torture have also continued, while fair trials have been denied, the experts said, before urging the council to keep following the situation by renewing their mandate beyond 1 year and providing sufficient resources to do so. Katie Dartford, UN News.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alice Smith.
Remember when the Texas grid fell down last winter and millions suffered in the cold? Our first guest, Judah Cohen, explains why waves of extreme cold and snow become more likely and predictable because the world is warming. Then we go to a last stand for the mighty Amazon rainforest, lungs of the world, with veteran Kerry Bowman. That carbon sink of the forests, absorbing up to 10% of our greenhouse gases that you and I dump into the atmosphere every day, it is starting to leak carbon dioxide instead. It's a huge concern. This is a packed show, so let's go. In 2018, I asked, if the planet is warming, why this awful winter weather? In February 2021, a wild cold snap crippled people and power right down to Texas. Will it happen again next winter? Our guest, Dr. Judah Cohen, thinks he knows why brutal winter storms are possible in the Northern Hemisphere, even though winters and the world are supposed to be warming. Judah Cohen is the director of seasonal forecasting at AER, which is the private company Atmospheric and Environmental Research. Cohen is also a research affiliate at the Parsons Lab at MIT, and he's the author of many scientific papers. I've been following his work for some years. He's been on Radio EcoShock a couple of times previously. So now, Judah Cohen and his colleagues have published their most definitive statement yet on the ways a warming Arctic can bring cold outbreaks to parts of the Northern Hemisphere. And the paper's titled, Linking Arctic Variability and Change with Extreme Winter Weather in the United States. It was published in the journal Science in September 2021. From New England, Judah Cohen, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
A pleasure to be here. Thanks, Alex.
So, Judah, you have some recent tweets out with the first signals about possibilities for this coming winter. What are the signs?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to preface by saying it's very early. I'm more of a teasing, you know, trying to tease with the tweets more than give any kind of forecast. But as you know, as we show in the paper, there's a natural or standing wave across the Eurasian continent. So you have the ridge or the crest of the wave across northwest Eurasia with the trough of the wave across northeast Asia. And anytime that wave becomes amplified or greater in magnitude, that then favors a disruption to the polar vortex and these cold air outbreaks like we saw last February in Texas. And the models have been suggesting that towards the end of September, maybe even into later fall months, that kind of pattern that we identified in the papers being favorable for these cold air outbreaks might be setting up. So I've just been teasing, and certainly if that pattern continues, then I think the risk cold air outbreaks will increase. But I mean, we're a long ways from there. I mean, obviously, September, you know, many things can change, and more of a teasing mode, trying to get people's attention, you know, turning away from summer.
It was phenomenal what happened all the way down to Texas. It was the whole south, really, in the central plains, but the power system broke down and stayed down for some time. It was very expensive. As you point out in your new paper, it can be more expensive than hurricanes.
Definitely. We know for sure that it was the most expensive winter weather event, I think, in history, certainly the U.S., but probably, you know, globally. And actually, it may turn out to be the most expensive natural disaster or, you know, weather disaster in Texas's history, which is better known for hurricanes, maybe droughts, certainly flooding as well. And yet, things we don't associate Texas with, you know, extreme cold and snow, it may turn out to be the most expensive natural disaster in their history.
And you work on signs and signals way up in the atmosphere, in the stratosphere, so that's above 12 kilometers or about 7.5 miles. I know it differs at the poles and the equator, but say roughly, it gives people a picture. And I know I've asked you this before. Listeners always want to know, if all the weather we experience develops in the lower layer, the troposphere below that, sort of a thin layer, how and why do changes in the stratosphere manage to affect the weather below?
That's a great question. Most of the mass, I'd say about 90% of the mass of the atmosphere, actually exists in the troposphere, and only 10% maybe above that, and you know, a good fraction of that is in the stratosphere, not all of it. So it is a kind of analogous to the tail wagging the dog to say that the stratosphere is influencing our weather. And with the most common or best studied polar vortex disruption, which we refer to as sudden stratospheric warming, is because there's very dramatic warming over the polar stratosphere, over the Arctic and the stratosphere. We don't really know or understand how that signal gets from the polar vortex to the troposphere and then it impacts the weather. It takes about 2 weeks. So I think really one nice result of our paper is that we really show that signal originates here in the troposphere you know, where all the weather is, where the jet stream is. And the polar vortex is just acting as some kind of medium for transferring that signal from Eurasia to North America. So actually the signal, as I described about the wave, so if the wave gets stronger, it gives off more energy. And what happens is that energy then boomerangs. So it goes. So energy in the atmosphere doesn't only just propagate or, you know, move horizontally, but it moves vertically. You know, like a sound wave would move in all directions, so the same thing. So the energy kind of, so the Eurasian wave gets energized and it gives off more energy, and that energy then goes up towards the stratosphere and actually boomerangs or bounces off the polar vortex and then goes down towards North America. So I think it's, you know, it's much more easier for us to understand, and physically that's, we can follow the signal from start to finish, which doesn't exist with this other much more studied polar vortex disruption, you know, and this is open question how exactly it influences our weather.
Well, right. Let's dig into some of the science behind this new winter weather forecasting. Scientists have discovered new disruptive activities in the stratosphere, and one of them, and people were intrigued and alarmed to hear about this, it's called sudden stratospheric warming. They sound like powerful events, and maybe they're similar to what we worry may happen here on the surface, some kind of sudden warming. What is sudden stratospheric warming, and why does it matter to weather forecasting?
You know, it's very dramatic. So something will happen in the, there's this warming that happens in the polar stratosphere that we actually won't see in the troposphere. Like at the pole, the temperatures can warm by more than 70 degrees Celsius or over 100 degrees Fahrenheit in just a matter of days. So, I mean, you know, we would not see that, you know, at the surface. So it's much more dramatic than anything we see with our weather. But with that warming, the atmosphere has to kind of balance itself out. So a lot of the pressure has to balance that warming. So typically over the Arctic, both in the troposphere and the stratosphere, you tend to have cold, low pressure. When you get these sudden stratospheric warmings, not only does you get this dramatic warming, but also you get a very inflating of the pressure. So you get much higher pressure over the Arctic, and that's because warm air is lighter than cold air. So it's maybe a little complicated. I don't want to get too complicated with it, but just like cold air, it's much denser, so the pressure levels condense. We just refer to that as low pressure. It's really lower in altitude. And then the warm air is lighter, so the atmospheric layers kind of bulge out, dilate upwards, so you get high pressure because they increase in altitude. It's higher altitude. So you get warm air over the Arctic with high pressure. And that tends to move so around the polar vortex, we have a jet. It's not the jet stream, but it's a jet. So it's a fast-moving ribbon of air, similar to our jet stream, but it's not exactly the same. And that tends to move towards the equator, and that allows cold air to go much lower latitudes. And so that what happens in the polar vortex, about 2 weeks later, again, for reasons we don't fully understand, but we do observe it, 2 weeks later, it kind of replicates or mimics what happened in the stratosphere. So you get warm high pressure over the Arctic, so you can get these also very sudden, you know, kind of warming of temperatures. Maybe if it's normal temperature in the Arctic is, you know, minus 30 degrees C or something close to that, it can even get close to the freezing point. You have, you know, I guess that high pressure, and then the jet stream moves equatorward, and that allows colder air that's typically over the Arctic to move to much lower latitudes, and you get these Arctic or cold air outbreaks, which we're familiar with both in in Canada and the U.S. So that's why these sudden stratospheric warmings are important for our weather.
So your new paper says sudden stratospheric warming events are actually decreasing since 1990. But a different, a more subtle kind of disturbance in the upper atmosphere is increasing. Please explain what stretching of the stratospheric polar vortex is.
Yeah, so I just want to correct one thing. We didn't show that the sudden stratospheric warmings are decreasing. We just showed that the stretched polar vortex events are increasing even more rapidly than the sudden stratospheric warmings.
Okay.
And the other thing that's very important is that sudden stratospheric warmings are related or associated with extreme cold in Eurasia, where the stretched polar vortex events are more closely related or associated with extreme cold in North America. So that's another important thing. So, yeah, so we showed that in general, so I'll group them, sudden stratospheric warmings and the stretched polar vortex a kind of a weakening or disruption of the polar vortex, and those are happening more frequently. And the strong kind of modes or phases of the polar vortex are decreasing. So there's kind of this compensation from strong polar vortex to weak polar vortex. And we know we get an increase in extreme winter weather at in the mid-latitudes when we have either disruption of the polar vortex. So, you know, which continent is favored, you know, depends which disruption you get. So the stretched polar vortex, as I was trying to explain earlier, so this energy leaves the Eurasian continent. This naturally occurring wave, of course, Eurasia becomes greater in magnitude or is amplified. It gives off more energy, and that energy then moves both horizontally and vertically, and that vertical component then will kind of bounce off of the polar vortex. Some of that energy actually, a little bit, gets absorbed into the polar vortex, and that's what actually causes it to stretch. So that's why we kind of refer to it as a stretched polar vortex. But most of the energy then boomerangs or bounces off the polar vortex and heads back into the troposphere. And again, there's this kind of natural wave that occurs across Eurasia with the ridge across the crest of the wave across the western part of the continent, you know, so near Alaska, and then troughing, you know, east of the Rockies, that trough of the wave. And that energy gets absorbed and kind of supercharges that wave. It becomes much greater in magnitude and in amplitude. It becomes of greater extent spatially, so that this more vigorous exchange of air masses, so warm air that's in the subtropics, let's say, gets transported towards the Arctic, typically towards Alaska. So there's a pretty significant warming of Alaska during many of these events, and then the cold air that's typically over the Arctic, over Alaska, let's say, northwest Canada, gets displaced southward and heads south east of the Rockies, and so last February was a great example of that. That cold air built up in Canada, brought record cold temperatures to the plains of Canada, the Canadian plains, and then it entered the northern plains of the U.S. and went all the way south. It was a bit of an unusual event that it went so far south like that, but,
Yeah, okay. So in the paper you ask, and I quote, could climate change have contributed to the observed increasing trends in the stratospheric polar vortex stretching events that forced cold to extreme cold in North America and East Asia? What did you find?
Yeah, we try to argue that yes, it contributed. It made the Texas cold wave more likely. I'm not going to say it wouldn't have happened without Arctic change. These events, this is not a new phenomenon. We're not arguing that this is something that didn't exist before. It always existed. It's just been over the satellite era, when we could sense or, observe everything that's going on in the atmosphere, both the troposphere and stratosphere. So that satellite period, it has been increasing. It's almost doubled in number. We're not saying that's going to just extrapolate that out forever. But there's certainly been a very noticeable increase. And we had both an observational or empirical analysis component. We did multiple types of analysis, and it certainly linked this increasing number of these stretched polar vortex events, so this increasing frequency, with Arctic change. And we also had a numerical modeling component to the study where we initialized a model with the trends that we're observing in with the changes in Arctic sea ice and snow cover across Siberia. And it also, when the model was initialized or forced with those Arctic trends, it also gave an increased number of these stretched polar vortex events. So very nice consistency we found between our observational empirical analysis and our modeling experiments. So we felt very confident that, there was a connection between the two.
Well, you're a guy who really pays attention to snow cover over in what we would call Russia, whereas a lot of scientists and the public have really been looking at sea ice cover and the lack of sea ice as a sign of global warming. Why is the snow cover important, and is it decreasing or increasing?
Much of my early career was focused on studying the relationship between Siberian snow cover in the fall and winter weather in North America. But then the sea ice and the changes in the sea ice and maybe its impact on our weather got a lot more attention. It became a much bigger area of focus or concentration than the snow cover was getting. So, my attitude then was, at first I saw them as my competition, but then I figured can't beat them, join them. So I started also looking at sea ice. And I think they're, two sides maybe of the same coin. They're it's all part of, you know, this more comprehensive Arctic change. So snow cover is decreasing in the spring and summer, and that was expected, and I think that's what people would, you know, are most familiar with. What is surprising and lesser known is that snow cover is actually, or snowfall is increasing in the fall season, the autumn season, across both continents. Actually, last year, North America had, you know, records snow cover extent, I think for the October and close to it for the whole fall season. So that was not something the models anticipated, projected. In the winter, you know, I think maybe there's a close to normal, you know, hasn't been much of a change, but certainly a very noticeable increasing trend in the fall. And I've tried to argue that that could have, you know, important implication for our weather, because more snow cover across Siberia in the fall favors an increased number of polar vortex disruptions. Before this study, I really thought, okay, those polar vortex disruptions were really the sudden stratospheric warmings. I mean, this study, we showed, it can, you know, can be, but actually snow cover is more likely to force a stretch polar vortex, which was, you know, the focus of our study, more so than even a sudden stratospheric warming. So that was kind of you know, something I've been studying for more than two decades, and it was, you know, you think you can't teach an old dog new tricks, and it was really something new that I'd realized with the study. But it, you know, answered some questions, lingering questions I had in the back of my mind, like I just didn't understand.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is scientist and professional weather forecaster Judah Cohen. We're looking ahead to winter and why extreme cold can happen even during global warming. So let's go a little bit more global here. I know that your paper focuses on the U.S. Northeast, but will swings of the polar vortex cause similar cold bouts in other parts of the Northern Hemisphere? Where and where not?
We do know that disruptions of the polar vortex, or the polar vortex weakens, there's an increase in cold air outbreaks across the Northern Hemisphere. So as I've been discussing, there are two types of polar vortex disruptions or weakenings. The one that's better, is most well known and more studied, is the sudden stratospheric warming. Those are associated or related with extreme cold across northern Eurasia, so both northern Asia and northern Europe. And we did show in a previous paper that those are increasing as well. And the type that we really focus on in this new study is the stretch polar vortex. So that favors cold air outbreaks, or, you know, is related to cold air outbreaks both in Canada and the U.S. east of the Rockies, and it is also related or associated with cold air outbreaks into East Asia. In the paper, we did also show that leading up to the event, northern Europe can turn colder as well. The signal wasn't as strong or as robust as for, let's say, Asia and eastern North America, but I think for Europe, most of the really cold air events most often associated with these sudden stratospheric warmings.
And I see you cite in your paper that Chinese scholars published their research fairly recently on the relationships between Arctic warming and extra cold in northern China. How does that relate to your findings?
You know, last year we had, you know, that Texas outbreak. It was kind of like in the second to third week of February. So, and it really kind of climaxed that like right around the middle of the month, February 14th or so. And China had also record cold right at the beginning of the month, around February 1st, I think the coldest temperature recorded in like 50 years or more. So that's consistent with what we find. So again, the first thing that happens kind of in this dominoes of, you know, of different steps, or, you know, dynamical steps or pathways, is that the Eurasian way becomes more amplified, so it becomes greater in spatial extent. So that brings cold air down over East Asia, over China. So that was the first step. And then the energy boomerangs off the polar vortex and then amplifies or supercharges the North American wave about 2 weeks later. So what happened last year with extreme cold in China right around the 1st of February and then the extreme cold in the U.S. mid-month, you know, is very consistent with what we showed, you know, in the paper.
You're part of a stream of scientists working on this Arctic warming, colder winter relationship, including also people like Jennifer Francis and Dr. Overland. But the theory has met resistance from others like Mark Cerise at the Snow and Ice Data Center. Has there been movement towards your findings and the tech that you are developing?
I think many of the scientists, I think, that have been skeptical, kind of bit, you know, oh, I don't want to, maybe incalcitrant, it's too strong of a warm word, but, you know, it certainly seems like people have dug into their, you know, respective camps. You're very skeptical that Arctic change can force colder weather in the mid-latitudes, or if you're, you know, you believe it, that is the case. And I don't know how many people that, you know, maybe convinced to change their mind, but I do think, you know, certainly the media, I think, has, I don't know, the word enamored is the right word, but, you know, certainly, you know, they've taken an interest to it, and there have been, you know, quite a few articles, you know, usually there are quite a few articles when you get extreme winter weather events, such as the Texas cold wave. I think the public, you know, has also maybe embraced it quite a bit, and I think young scientists, you know, maybe who didn't think about this, maybe, you know, when they're young and maybe more open to different ideas, sometimes kind of iconoclastic ideas. I think they, you know, they have many more of these young scientists, you know, have come to think about this problem and, you know, maybe are certainly at least interested in pursuing it through their own studies. So, you know, I think that's something that we've seen over the past decade or so. You know, I think a lot of the resistance comes to it because it is counterintuitive. If you're warming the globe, you're especially rapidly warming the Arctic, why should that lead, you know, the coldest place in the Northern Hemisphere, why should that lead to colder temperatures in places that are much warmer than the Arctic? I mean, I understand the resistance or hesitancy to the idea, but, you know, all the research that I've done now for over two decades leads me to believe that that actually is the case.
So are we at the point, Judah Cohen, where we can predict cold excursions during Northern Hemisphere winters and where they're likely to hit? And if so, how far in advance, how much warning can we give with this system of monitoring changes in the stratosphere?
Certainly if we see a sudden stratospheric warming, we know to expect. This is certainly an increased risk of extreme winter weather. Most of the research thought it could be anywhere in the northern, well, not anywhere in the northern hemisphere, but eastern North America, northern Europe, northern Asia. I think some of the studies that I've been involved with, including this study, really shows that it's more focused in northern Europe and northern Asia. And then our study shows that when you have a stretch polar vortex, again, there's this increased risk of cold air outbreaks across the whole northern hemisphere, but more focused in East Asia and eastern Canada, the eastern U.S. That helps us, you know, maybe prepare, because if you see sudden stratospheric warming, you know that the higher risk is across northern Europe, northern Asia. If you see a stretch polar vortex happening, then you know the higher risk is Canada than the U.S. I'm going to date myself with this thing, but you know, I think the stretch polar vortex was kind of, it was like the Rodney Dangerfield, you know, of polar vortex disruptions. It really didn't get the recognition and respect I think it deserves, because it can have a really big impact on our weather. So I'm hoping now that people look at it and say, oh, wow, this can have a big impact. It could lead to these. And, you know, and the Texas cold wave was certainly not the only really extreme winter weather. There are many that we just didn't realize was connected to these stretch polar vortex events. So, you know, if we could recognize it, the models can maybe predict the weather up to 2 weeks in advance. Obviously, that second week, the accuracy of those forecasts really drop off. You know, they kind of degenerate. Kind of, again, if we could see that amplification or this growing in magnitude and extent of the, and if we know what the polar vortex is favorable for, you know, kind of reflecting or acting like where that energy can bounce off the polar vortex, then I think we can get maybe 2 to 3 weeks lead time, at least say, hey, the conditions are favorable for one of these events, so let's, you know, raise the awareness. Yeah, obviously, I still think it would be hard to predict every one of these events and know exactly where the focus of the impact will be, but at least we can start looking at and monitoring, you know, maybe just like we might do with a hurricane, you know, in the development region, you know, the North Atlantic, off Africa. Of course, we don't know where that tropical wave or, you know, which will maybe turn into a hurricane, where it may end up, but we at least know, we start monitoring. So maybe something analogous to that, at least I think we could, you know, raise in advance the monitoring, you know, that we need to be on guard and to follow and see how it plays out.
Well, I know you have a scientific interest in figuring out how this works, but also you work for this company, Atmospheric and Environmental Research, and no doubt they have governments and corporate clients who will pay to know if these events are coming. Who will use this new forecasting tech as it develops further?
I mean, the people that certainly, I think, traditionally have been most interested, you know, in these extreme winter weather events have been natural gas traders, because when you get these cold air outbreaks, you get a spike in gas prices. And, you know, the same would go even for utilities. I mean, obviously they have a range. But, I mean, I myself have been surprised by the different organizations and sectors that are interested. Certainly wildlife, let's say in Florida, if they get these cold air outbreaks, you know, it affects the wildlife down there, the manatees and the iguanas that famously fall out of the trees. I mean, there's not that much agriculture. I think these events can have, especially as you get towards that transition from winter to spring, I mean, it certainly can impact the agriculture as well. And, you know, people, public works departments are very much interested in these forecasts, because if there's a snowstorm, obviously they need to be prepared with the machines and the salt.
Yeah, for a long time we've been told to expect warmer winters based on the climate models, and I'm wondering maybe municipalities will not replace as many snowplows, or maybe companies won't spend on cold resistance for their power systems if they think that's what's going to happen. What does your work tell them?
You know, one of the more important takeaways from the study was, if you're, you know, in, you know, a decision maker, you're in public works, you know, you work for local governments, and you're saying, well, I don't need to put as much resources in, you know, towards resiliency, or, you know, preparing for extreme winter weather, because the globe is warming and that's just going to, you know, so it's going to be milder winters, less snow. I don't need to put the resources towards that. It says, you know, it may not be, you know, that extreme winter weather may not disappear as quickly as you anticipate, and you should still, you know, at least in the near future, still need to prepare for it. And, you know, and so like Texas didn't really build up the resiliency to extreme winter weather, and they certainly paid the price last winter. And our paper says that, you know, that maybe, you know, even a place like Texas still may need to, you know, be prepared for extreme winter weather events. You know, have some kind of contingency plans in place when you get even, you know, like an historical event. You know, I mean, I think it's very complicated how climate change is impacting winter weather, but it's not as simple as it, you know, the globe is warming and so winters are going to get milder and there's going to be less snow. That Arctic change is also leading to these more polar vortex disruptions, which can favor these more extreme events. And it's really what we're observing is the combination of those two factors.
Well, I predict it's going to take some time for the public to realize, as they're digging out from this record snowfall somewhere in the Northeast, that, yeah, this is part of, you know, Arctic warming and global warming. It's going to take a while for people to realize, like you say, it's counterintuitive.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, people have used cold, you know, extreme weather, winter weather events to say, oh, well, you know, there's no global warming. How can it be so cold? How can we get so much snow if there's global warming and there's climate change happening? So our paper says, you know, there's a physical connection. It may not be intuitive, but we can show why they're consistent with each other, and that one is not, doesn't refute the other. You know, a heavy, big snowstorm doesn't mean there's no climate change, no global warming, but they can be consistent with each other.
We've been speaking with Dr. Judah Cohen, professional long-range weather forecaster for the company AER, and you can find links to the science we talked about and Judah's updates on large-scale weather trends in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Judah, thank you for keeping us ahead in this science.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I was happy to be able to join you again.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
When the sea ice hit a shocking low in 2007, we all knew climate change had tipped in some way. Now we have news of another dangerous line crossed. The Amazon rainforest, the so-called lungs of the planet, is starting to exhale carbon dioxide instead of capturing it. And the revelation comes quietly in a paper in the journal Nature. It came out almost unnoticed in mid-July during a pandemic, wildfires, and social distress. The title is Amazonia as a Carbon Source Linked to Deforestation and Climate Change. This has global implications for warming and the extreme weather many of you are going through right now. Dr. Kerry Bowman knows the Amazon. He has been there. Kerry is a difficult man to describe. He's teaching in two faculties, medicine and the School of Environment. He works at both fields. He's with the Canadian University of Toronto. Kerry Bowman, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Happy to be here.
Should we call you a climate doctor or a physician for the planet or what? It's a wild mix.
None of those things. Just call me Kerry.
Okay.
I don't seem to fit well into any of the categories, and I'm okay with that.
News and new science is coming in almost as fast as the Amazon is disappearing. It's so hard to keep up. Let's get to the big ticket item, though. Countless studies and reports assume the Amazon rainforest captures 5 to 10% of the emissions we humans dump into the atmosphere. That's a big number. But a new study led by the Brazilian researcher Luciana Gatti finds part of the rainforest has tipped. The great rainforest is now letting out more greenhouse gases than it consumes. Kerry, how should we understand that?
Well, sadly, let's just start with the science. Now, this was a very, very thorough study, you know, in which some studies come out, and when you really look at the depth of the data, there's not much there, but not this study. I mean, this was done over a seven-year period. It was done with extensive flyovers of the Amazon. I mean, anyone listening can certainly look that up on Nature. It was mostly the regions within the southern Amazon, but, you know, that really is a lot of the Amazon and kind of the heart of the Amazon as well. And you know, what they're really seeing is all these tremendous benefits that the Amazon forest has in terms of stabilizing, you know, and being really an anchor for essentially, to be honest with you, global climate and global weather patterns is receding. There's losses. And it's a nasty cycle. So, you know, to go from carbon sink to carbon faucet is like, how scary is that? And it's a gradual process. But remembering that the Amazon itself is just almost a pump in terms of pumping, you know, oxygen and humidity and all the things that we need into the atmosphere. And with the tremendous erosion and drying out, particularly in the southern Amazon, secondary, without question, to human intervention of burning and hacking and killing forests. This has really led to the opposite effect happening. It's very worrisome. It's very worrisome. You know, it's almost impossible for anyone, including me, to say this is exactly what it means and this is exactly what's going to happen because we don't know. And I'm not even going to pretend to being, you know, the top. I'm absolutely not the top climate scientist on how the Amazon would work. I'm very familiar with the Amazon. But the Amazon is needed in, you know, the Earth itself, as we all know, is an ecosystem. And the Amazon is the biggest rainforest on the face of the Earth. It's also the greatest expression of life on Earth. When I say expression of life, I'm talking about, you know, the level of biodiversity. There's nowhere on Earth that's a stronger expression of life than the Amazon forest. And it's in decline. It's in erosion. And with the climate crisis as it deepens, we really need the stability of the Amazon to buffer us and you know, help us with all the challenges ahead. And we're losing ground on that. And that's why this study is so very important and so very worrisome. And look, let me just say something quite self-evident. If it wasn't for this damn pandemic, you know, the one of the many problems with this pandemic is there is critically important environmental and other emergencies emerging all over the world that get very, very little coverage because we're so drawn into this complex pandemic that is taking us now years to get through.
I totally agree. I worry that some of the stories that I do just aren't making it because people are concerned naturally about their economy, their jobs, their health, and what's going on right around them. So Dr. Gatti simply says the Amazon change is partly because of deforestation. And as we speak, the anti-environmental president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, has asked the courts to quash the rights of indigenous people in the Amazon. He wants logging and mining and widespread settlement of the Amazon, comparing it to settling the Old West in America. I mean, that's their rights, he says. So from your perch in Canada, what have you heard about the political drive to kill the Amazon rainforest?
Well, I'll tell you, there's what I've heard and what I've seen. Remembering, I've been in the Amazon every year, except for the last year because of the pandemic situation. Every year for the last nine, I myself have been in the Western Amazon, and my work is at the interface of the trinational borders of Brazil, Peru, and Colombia. And particularly, let me speak of Brazil. What I have seen is the incredible erosion of laws and respect for the indigenous people in their land. And that's where my research sits, is looking at when areas are declared indigenous and protected as indigenous, what is the effect in relation to biodiversity, and what is the effect in terms of, you know, deforestation? And, you know, to state something that people might find not surprising, biodiversity is very stable, and deforestation, once areas are declared indigenous, in almost all cases, completely stops, and in fact, forests tend to recover. So the fact that Bolsonaro is as anti-indigenous as he is of a grave concern, not just from a civil rights point of view, and civil rights is tremendously important, but also from an environmental point of view. And, you know, increasingly with environmental concerns, what we're seeing is there's this huge interface between human rights and environmental protection. And, you know, the days of these things being seen as siloed are really gone. And, you know, presently Brazil is looking at constructing, well, passing laws. They've already constructed the laws of passing laws that if indigenous claims weren't proven earlier than about, I think the year is 1985 or 1988, one of those 2 years, then in fact they won't be valid. If this were to occur, you know, a lot would be lost. A lot of protected indigenous Brazilian areas would be lost. And with those losses, there will absolutely be more degradation and loss of biodiversity. There's no question. And it's a complicated equation. I mean, look, this is tied to soy and it's tied to beef and it's tied to international trade. So, you know, this is not, all of us are in this together because this is really a global problem. And when people say, we really have no right to be telling Brazil what to do, I would argue we do on two grounds. One, the environmental implications have massive effects of all of us on the planet Earth. And also when violations of human rights reach a certain threshold, which I would argue they have in Brazil, it is everyone's business to stand up to that.
Yes, we're buying steaks in chain restaurants without realizing that people who really have no defense, and this includes even uncontacted people in the Amazon, people who have not had, they're not going to the courts or anything else. They're trying to live in the forest where they've lived since time immemorial. I just feel like it is time for the rest of us to stand up and say, well, where are our wood products coming from? Where is our meat coming from? What are we doing to the lungs of the planet?
Yeah, and our soy. Soy is another big one. And, you know, the food chain's complex in which, you know, massive, and everyone thought, I don't know how many years ago, but several years ago, that soy, oh, what a good idea that is. Well, you know, a little more complicated than that, because soy products, in many cases, China buys most of the soy from Brazil. So China purchases most of the soy from Brazil, and that is really used for pigs within China. And so you've got this complicated, and so I'm not saying China is the only consumer and the only problem in this complicated equation, but there's a lot there. And the pandemic has created a very, very good cover for Bolsonaro, in which the world's attention is greatly diverted on other things, and there's been a deeper erosion of indigenous rights, and there's been a deeper erosion of environmental protection. The uncontacted, most of the uncontacted people, meaning, so these are people now called very frequently isolated tribes. They're mostly in the Western Amazon. Now, we don't know how many there is, but they are living in what are essentially pristine ecosystems. I've actually seen the uncontacted. I have never gone looking for them. I've gone to great lengths to try and avoid them for ethical reasons. As well as safety reasons, and I mean not just my safety, but their safety as well in terms of viruses and things like that. Yet I've actually seen the uncontacted. And if you roll this back about 12 years, you had governments like Peru and some in Brazil saying they don't even exist. This is just a bunch of environmentalists that have created these mythical Neolithic tribes that don't exist, and they absolutely do. And they have every right to stay where they are. And if they choose contact, they would know how to do that. They would know what rivers to take to come across human settlements. And so there's another human rights element. And the areas where the uncontacted are have high levels of biodiversity and are tremendous carbon holds, carbon sinks.
Well, I don't have a lot of hope for the COP climate conferences. The next one's coming up in Glasgow this winter. My friends say the COP climate conferences are where climate action goes to die. Maybe not that bad, but three Brazilian scientists just published a letter in Nature a couple of days ago calling for the Amazon to move way up on the agenda for COP26. And the UK promised a truly global meeting, but we just learned some delegates have not seen their promised COVID-19 shots that would allow them to attend. They won't get vaccinated in time. One negotiator from the Democratic Republic of Congo told Climate Home News, the biggest frustration is the feeling that some are trying to organize the summit without the participation of certain countries. The feeling that the UK government is telling us, don't come. Kerry, I know you're tied into the pandemic, you're working on it, and you have worked on the rainforest action in the Congo too. Talk to us. What are we looking at here?
What we're looking at is the fact that gone are the days where we can have people from high-income Western countries really defining, rather, every problem. I mean, we really, really need to be hearing directly from the people of the Amazon basin and the Congo basin as well. I continue to work, by the way, in the Congo basin. I work there as well. And yeah, you know, it is so important that they not just be at the conferences, but that they are helping to define the challenges that they are facing and that the solutions to those challenges are really emerging from the cultures, the forest cultures in many cases, not exclusively, but the forest cultures of regions like Congo. And, you know, the problem with a big group like COP is it tends to be very Western, educated, sophisticated, intimidating, you know, a nice cold, out-of-touch place like, where is it, Scotland, right? Nothing against Scotland, but this is a hell of a long way from the realities of tropical forests and what people are facing. And, you know, if they're not there, and more than being there, if they're not completely foundational to the methods that evolve from something like that, it will never work. So it's so very important that they should be there.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Dr. Kerry Bowman from the University of Toronto, and we are covering the Amazon and we're covering world deforestation. So then we have an odd but challenging paper from two Italian physicists published in 2020. Never heard about it in the news. The title sounds pretty plain, Deforestation and World Population Sustainability, a Quantitative Analysis. So it's led by Mauro Bologna, and he says civilization has already killed off one-third of all forest cover on Earth. Now that's a stunning statistic right there. And at our current rate of destruction, forests would be gone in 100 to 200 years. And as that happens, they say, civilization itself has a less than 10% chance of surviving. I wonder, could we really survive on a planet without forests? Can we just have a few nice-looking trees around on our lawns and pave the rest over and build some cities? What do you think?
Well, I think it's virtually impossible, but I'm expressing an opinion. It's a complex question. I cannot imagine how the Earth as it is now, with tropical forests being the, you know, the center, the belt of the entire planet, you know, obviously except the ocean regions. This is critical to the survival of the Earth. So, you know, very, very important that they be preserved. Very important that they be preserved. And you know, the population element is an interesting, emotional, and challenging one. One of the challenges is we're very silenced on talking about population. Because in the 20th century, population was very much tied, and to some extent now, with racism and very negative attitudes towards women. But when we look at high-income countries, if, you know, a person born into North American society, most estimates will be that their footprint is over 100 times higher than the average African. So it's huge. And population is part of an extremely complex equation. But the problem is, It is so emotional and so political that we're kind of pretending it doesn't exist, and it does exist. Particularly with biodiversity and forest loss, population is a real consideration. I'm not suggesting for a moment population should ever be controlled by the state. I am not suggesting that for a moment. But population and family planning, and I speak of high-income countries, by the way, is a moral question. There's no two ways about that. And it is something that people should speak about, not the state, but people should speak about. And I don't mean people in low-income countries having too many children. When you consider the impact of a high-income child is so massive, and I'm not saying people shouldn't have children in high-income countries either. What I am saying is it is a moral question, and pushing it out of conversations has done us no good.
It's kind of the nuclear bomb of talking about climate change to get into the population thing, but sooner or later we are going to have to do it. But I totally agree. If people in First Nations, the people with all of our emissions, could have one less child, we would have much more effect than trying to push this off into Africa or somewhere else. Now, we've got another common belief, and that is that wood is a sustainable resource forever. But changes in heat and drought and superfires can mean a clear-cut forest does not successfully regrow. We've talked about whether the Amazon can successfully recover. Do you think that people are still presuming that wood consumption is sustainable?
I think people are because, you know, I'm North American, and so I've kind of grown up in an environment where, you know, we were taught that, you know, trees will always recover. North American forests are much more evolved for fire, but, I mean, the fires are so much worse. But let's just consider something like the Amazon now and parts of the Congo, but I'll stay with the Amazon. Fire is not, N-O-T, a natural part of the cycles of the Amazon. The Amazon is far too humid and wet for that. Fires can occur naturally with lightning strikes, but they don't tend to go very far. And the Amazon is not evolved to recover from fires. So these horrible fires that are now seasonal, and look, they go back more than 100 years. I mean, a couple of hundred years, but not at this volume. And they go back as being man-made, by the way. The recovery is profoundly long-term and very, very difficult. So, you know, I think we have to be very careful. Now, there's people that know a lot more about these things than I do, but simply thinking that any kind of forest is just going to take care of itself and have full recovery, and I see the same in the Congo, it's much more complex than that, especially when you consider the amount of biodiversity loss that is coupled with deforestation. You know, the amount of species that are hunted and extracted and just obliterated. We cannot simply expect forests to recover naturally if we simply slow down a little. It's very simplistic to think that.
But even as we speak, countries in Europe, including the UK, are importing wood cut from forests all over the world to burn it as a supposedly green fuel. What do you think about that, Kerry?
Yeah, no, I'm very, very surprised. But, you know, one of the concerns is, and I've seen this in Africa and I've seen it in the Amazon, and Bolsonaro himself says so. Now, I speak more of Europe, and I'm not European, but, you know, I've interviewed many, many people in Central Africa, and they will say, you know, you foreigners, you white people, you cut down all the forests of Europe, which is pretty well true. And now you're going to tell us we're not allowed to cut our forests? I've heard similar things coming from South America. And, you know, I guess we haven't cut down all the forests of North America, but certainly Eastern North America, which is where I happen to live, used to be far more, it's recovering, but, you know, Eastern North America used to have substantial forests, which it doesn't now. So, you know, their point is a very interesting one because it's an element of colonialism where you did it, you did it for yourself to progress and, you know, to do all these things. And how can you tell us not to do it? And so they're actually making a very, very important point. When you consider places like Britain was forested. Scotland was forested. A lot of people don't even know that. Ireland was forested. A lot of people don't even realize these types of things. It's been so long since, they've been cut down.
Yeah, but now we do know that the lives of most living beings, including ourselves, are on the line. We have to keep some forests to create the oxygen we need, to grab the carbon dioxide, to be a home for all the living things and the medicines we haven't even discovered. I mean, you know all the arguments. I just feel like at some point we've got to make a defense of the forests wherever they are.
We do, and there's ways to do that. And, you know, one of the ways that's the top of that list, and I've seen this now all over the world, and I don't mean to sound simplistic on this, but it's respecting indigenous lives and cultures, because there is, and I could go on at length, I won't for time, but, you know, indigenous peoples within African society, like the Batwa, which are also known as the Pygmies, if you look at some of the indigenous peoples living within forest cultures, as forest societies, they really hold up a very strong example for us all. The concept of community forest, which has really evolved in a lot of African societies, forest African societies, I'm speaking primarily of Central and to a lesser extent West Africa, and even community forest. So community forest is a concept in which the community is responsible for the forest, and they're stewards of the forest. And I mean people living either in proximity to the forest or even within the forest. These things actually do work, and they do work very, very well. And this is the way that we will need to go forward. And when I say need, you know, this will emerge from the needs of the people living within forest societies. People in higher income countries need to stand back and figure out how we can support them politically in terms of human rights, in terms of making sure people have what they need to enact these types of things, but allowing the people to be the stewards of the forest.
You mentioned this at the beginning of our talk, how the pandemic is affecting deforestation and the climate and our awareness of it. Could you expand on that for us?
Well, the pandemic came from the forest, which is, and we're really losing track of that. So, you know, the SARS-CoV-2, which is what we're facing now, COVID-19, is a zoonotic disease. So zoonotic is coming from animals. So the massive amount of deforestation that is going on is also coupled with an incredible wildlife trade. And that's happening all over the world. That's happening in Southeast Asia, where this pandemic has come from. And if you might remember the SARS outbreak of 2003, that also came from animal markets, secondary in many cases to deforestation. The next pandemic could easily come from the Amazon, secondary to deforestation and wildlife trade. It could come from the Congo. Remember, Ebola, you know, has a link to deforestation. HIV, you know, came from slaughtered chimpanzees. Not that the chimpanzees actually have HIV, but viruses jump from one to the other. So two things have really been lost in this awful pandemic. One is that there's an environmental genesis to this pandemic that almost no one is talking about. And most people, the vast majority within medical cultures, know nothing about it or rarely, rarely mention it. The second thing, and I don't really blame anyone for this because the pandemic is an awful crisis. This pandemic, as we head towards two full years of a global crisis, has really put the lid on so many other critically important stories. The environmental crisis is 1,000 times more of a threat to us than this pandemic. This pandemic is awful, and it will probably drag on for a while, but it is not nearly the threat that the environmental crisis is to us. It's actually linked to it, and it is part of the threat, but it's not the only threat. And so that, you know, this is how the pandemic has really complicated this. My hope, and I guess there's still some hope for this, is that when this pandemic recedes, that the take-home message will be that environmental degradation contributed to this and deforestation is a part of this. But I feel very few people are talking about that. And it's our siloed educational element. There's very little education within medicine. And medicine's come a long way, by the way, and it's getting a lot better very quickly. But there's very little education in medicine in relation to planetary health and the large environmental picture. Very little, not none, by the way, not none.
Have you managed to keep in touch with the people you know in the Amazon, and what are you hearing?
It's hell. Particularly in Brazil, people are very, very frightened, waiting to see which way the legislation is going to go. There is hope that the election next year will be the end of these policies. Lula, who's the former president of Brazil, is now out of jail. Many would say he never belonged in jail, that they, you know, those were false charges, and will run for election, in which case things may get better should he win. But no one knows which way things are going to go. There's more and more incursion into very remote areas of the uncontacted, which have always been protected, and they're slowly allowing a lot of religious groups in. So that's a huge cultural risk, and it's also a massive viral risk with COVID and everything else, because uncontacted people will become sick very quickly, having never been exposed to the zillions of things that all of us have been exposed to from living in the complex societies we live in. Remember, they haven't. So they could become very sick and die very quickly, which is almost a kind of a genocide.
And since our Radio EcoShock interview in February 2020, what have you been up to? Do you want to talk at all about your work with the pandemic that's dragging you into that?
Well, I'm a bioethicist. So, yes, I have been talking a great deal about, the ethics of everything from vaccine passports to travel to all kinds of things related to that. What I've been trying to do is get the message out in terms of the relationship between this pandemic and environmental degradation. It hasn't gone far. And the many people in Western nations that are showing leadership on the pandemic, in fairness to them, they know very little about the environmental foundation of, what led to this pandemic. What worries me is many people are saying, well, we need a huge amount of surveillance to prepare for the next one. But again, we're not getting to the core of it. If we have surveillance to watch for the emergence, we're not upstream far enough. We have to go further upstream to halt the environmental destruction that caused this, because zoonotic infections, simply waiting for them and trying to get ahead of them as opposed to preventing them by securing forests around the world are two very different things. And medicine's kind of doing what it often does. It's looking at treatment and it's not looking at cause. And that's what's happening with this pandemic.
Part of my struggle is to get listeners who are possibly worrying about getting burned out or have just been flooded in New England or in Europe, climate change right in your face, to now look over to the poles, because what happens in Antarctica and Greenland really matter, but also to the Amazon and to the Congo, to find that those living systems that support us are in danger, and connect those two things, that if you care about what's hitting you outside your window and all these rains and fires and crazy winds and things, you've got to care about what's happening in those faraway places.
Yeah, it's very true. I find it a bit heartening in which Hurricane Ida, which of course has just gone right through the United States and really did a terrible number on New York City and New Jersey. What I find very encouraging is there's a lot of discourse about of course there's always been hurricanes, but there's a lot of conversation about how climate change likely contributed to the exacerbation. With the incredible heat waves in Western North America of the summer, there's a lot of conversation about the role of climate. Where there's not a lot of conversation is the pandemic. And if we could just, we tend to acknowledge weather calamities are climate related, but we're not at a point where we're acknowledging the potential and the almost certain relationship between environmental degradation and the emerging zoonotic infections. And look, explaining these links would be very complicated and beyond the scope of this interview, but I would encourage anyone who finds this interesting to simply, start looking up zoonotic diseases forests, and you will see very quickly what it is I am speaking of.
Where can listeners go to find out more about you and your work?
I don't know. I'm not on social media whatsoever. I don't know what I'm missing out on. No, I've had a few publications related to the Amazon just recently, so if you were to simply Google my name of Amazon, try Amazon Environmental Degradation and just Carrie Bowman or Carrie W. Bowman, because there's a few of us, Carrie W. Bowman, Carrie's K-E-R-R-Y. Yeah, those things will pop up.
From Toronto, Canada, we have been speaking with Kerry Bowman, assistant professor in both medicine and environmental studies. You can find links to the science that we've raised and news we've discussed in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Kerry, thank you for this Planet Health checkup. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's the way the world works, from forests to the Arctic to the stratosphere. Join me again next week as we examine the madness of crowds. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.